Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Today we are starting a series on creativity. Guests will include neuroscientists, clinicians, researchers, and performers. We'll try to answer questions about the physiology of creativity, how creativity and our health interact, and how we might use applied psychophysiology to enhance creativity in our clients and ourselves. We'll start the series off with a discussion about the neurophysiology of creativity. Dr. Rex Jung is a clinical neuropsychologist in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he's also worked as an assistant research professor of psychology at the University of New Mexico and a research scientist at the Mind Research Network. His research focuses on brain functions and structures that relate to creativity, intelligence, and pathology. He's published in a wide variety of journals and books across many subject areas, and is the co-editor of the Cambridge Handbook of the Neuroscience of Creativity. In this first part of our discussion, we talk about how to define creativity in a way that allows us to systematically study it, the difference between creativity and intelligence, and the neurophysiology involved in creative work. Dr. Jung, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Saul.
So I want to start with kind of how you got to creativity. You've had a really varied career, and you've worked in areas of neuropsychology, creativity, intelligence, neuroimaging. How did creativity kind of emerge as a major area of your study?
Yeah, good question. I stumbled into it, like I did most of the things that I researched, but it was a rational stumble, I guess. I had been studying, as you indicated, intelligence for a number of years, and came to understand that intelligence was not enough to really capture the reasoning behavior of humans, particularly in really unconstrained problem solving, and that creativity is something that was worth pursuing. And intelligence was important. Intelligence is quite adaptive, but in problems that are quite unconstrained, we need something more. And I hypothesized that creativity was that reasoning capacity that allowed us to get that something more that intelligence did not provide.
Okay, so I actually want to go back to that idea of unconstrained and constrained problem solving, but sticking with creativity just for a minute, it's typically been treated as a trait or a talent. And how has that thinking changed over time?
It may not have changed. it is a trait, a talent, artistic creativity, musical creativity. The way I look at it is more of a brain capacity, a reasoning capacity. So I think people still do look at it as a trait, a talent that people have in its manifestation, in its expression, in particular domains. Again, I tend to look at it in this more general term as a capacity of the brain to problem solve. And the problems that we're solving can be applied to art, music, business, science, a lot of particular domains that we're trying to create something novel and useful, the definition of creativity that can be surprising or unexpected, that hasn't been seen before. And that is a unique capacity of creativity.
So it's capacity, almost like a process rather than a thing.
Yeah.
So wondering then, of course, about the so
when you're looking
the neurology.
Sorry, to interrupt you. When you're looking at traits, you're looking at the things that people create, and when you're looking at this thing I'm talking about, you're looking at the process of creativity. It's a process produced by neural activity by the brain. So I think that's an important distinction that you're making.
Right. And well, of course, you know, psychologists are always interested in the process. But in particular, this process, how is neurology, how is the brain involved? What systems, what areas of the brain really get kicked in?
I think there's a lot of work that's been done in the last 10, 15 years that have really congealed around three broad brain networks, two broad brain networks, and perhaps a third, that are involved in creative cognition. The default mode network is a network in the brain that is organized around internal processing, about introspection and planning and organizing our behaviors before we implement them into the world broadly. It is in the mesial aspects of the brain, largely, although not exclusively. Executive control network or cognitive control network, sometimes called the task positive network, is involved in implementing those ideas, down selecting from all the ideas generated into one that is most viable. And the interplay between the default mode network and the cognitive control network is mediated or modulated, perhaps, we believe, by the salience network. What is most salient in terms of environmental cues that are driving the demands from the environment and how we are processing that internally to create the best response to environmental demands. So three networks, default cognitive control, executive control network, and the salience network are working in harmony to produce the cognitive processes of novelty generation with the default mode network, largely but not exclusively, appropriateness or task selection, which is being modulated by the executive control network, largely but not exclusively, and the interplay of these with the salience network. So a lot of work has been done in this regard to identify these networks with both structural and functional imaging techniques, mostly functional imaging techniques, and looking at particular subjects like jazz artists, jazz performance artists, most famously, people doing playing pianos in the fMRI suite, things of that nature, and people doing creative like tasks, which we'll probably end up talking about in the scanner.
So the networks sort of interact with each other, maybe modulated or even mediated by the salience network. So does this get to what you were talking about, unconstrained problem solving? So the default mode network is sort of things are floating around, and the salience network kind of says, oh, go for that one?
Yeah, I think the default mode network becomes engaged in novelty generation, and there is a tamping down of the selection process and down regulation of possibilities that normally goes on in our brain. So the salience network is attuned to the interplay of those demands coming from the external environment and then our internal states and managing those two together. So is there a matching between the external demands and the internal states of our body and brain? So it's not making the selection per se, but it's tuning the interplay between the external environment and the internal environment of our body and mind.
Okay. And so how does that relate to intelligence? I feel like I'm jumping the gun a little bit with that question, but it's because those networks, I think, would be related to intelligence as well, but you see these as different processes, different...
I hypothesized that they would be when I went into this, and they largely are, although they overlap. So intelligence is largely involved with the task-positive network, the cognitive control network, and we've written a target article in the Behavioral and Brain Sciences on the parietal frontal integration theory, PFIT, in 2007, which really outlined a network of regions involved in intelligent behavior, looking at the fMRI studies and structural imaging studies, EEG studies, all the studies that were available at that time. And that's held up pretty well. This cognitive control network, task positive network, is highly involved in intelligent behavior, intelligence, IQ studies that have emerged. So that's half the story in creativity, not all the story in creativity. And the default mode network tends not to be involved, and salience network tends not to be implicated as highly in intelligence type of tasks as they are in creativity tasks. So the default mode network is much more highly involved in creativity type tasks, particularly novelty generation. And the cognitive control network is much more highly involved in intelligence type tasks. And I still would hypothesize that these both are critically important to adaptive behavior in the environment. And when you start looking at the interplay between intelligence and creativity, you also find out that there's lots of overlap, that intelligence is correlated with these measures of creativity that we have, and that intelligence is perhaps very important to creativity, because you have to acquire information and bits of data to put together in novel and useful ways. You can't create something from nothing, so you have to have resources and application of your intelligence in order to manifest it in creative ways. So they work in tandem. I've always hypothesized, and haven't been unconvinced of this yet, that intelligence is necessary but not sufficient for highly creative activities. You have to have some intelligence to be able to put these ideas in place in order for them to be used in creative endeavors.
But you need the ideas first.
You do.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's perhaps, I mean, the analogy that I use when I'm giving talks is, you know, we all adore the creativity of our children, especially toddlers and whatnot. But it's perhaps only really useful in terms of painting a picture on our refrigerator doors, the art that they create. It's not particularly useful to a broader audience. They really haven't put all the pieces together to create something particularly novel, right, and useful to a broader audience. They don't have the ingredients necessary to become, and not that everyone's going to become a Picasso or a Van Gogh or something like that, but all the ingredients necessary to perhaps appeal to a larger audience of art aficionados besides or outside of their parents, per
right.
se.
That's a different value set, I think, is that
correct?
But
yes.
That does actually really raise a question about the differentiating the Picassos from the rest of us. So you talked about brain imaging studies. Could you talk a little bit about what they show for people who are successful creatives or highly creatives?
Yeah, very little research has been done. We recently published some studies a series of studies looking at people who are considered to be high creative achievers as compared to people, their cohorts, who are high achievers without being perhaps creative achievers, perhaps highly intelligent. Mm. So think of someone like Steven Pinker, who writes books and articles and gives talks and, you know, is a public intellectual, as opposed to your average Harvard professor, who is highly intelligent but perhaps not as renowned as someone like that. So, and I wouldn't feel comfortable holding forth on what we found. We found differences in the brains of people that are highly creative. We call that big C compared to little c creativity. All humans, by all animals, I would hypothesize, all mammals at least, have creative capacity to solve novel problems in a useful manner. But the little c and big c creativity is mostly a product of how broadly accepted it is within the culture. So you think again of Steven Pinker, and yeah, his books sell. My books don't. Your books might. I don't know.
No, they do not. They do not.
but some books sell. Van Gogh's paintings are highly popular. But when he was painting them, he was not popular. It took a good bit of time after his death for the world to actually recognize the genius of Van Gogh. So it is a perception of creativity that is an acceptance by public consensus that gets you that big C creativity, whether it's deserved or not.
Well, that may take us on a little bit of a tangent. I don't mean to do that, but that raises the question to what is creativity, and how much, whether it's the preschooler with the painting on the refrigerator or the Van Gogh that never sells during his lifetime, can we say they're not creative because the perception, the outside perception, is that they're not, or their outside values don't kind of match with that creativity? What is that telling us about creativity, and how do we pull that apart from what's lighting up in the brain during a creative task?
Yeah, I think the things that are lighting up in the brain during a creative task are similar regardless of whether people are accepting it broadly or not. I think this concept of, you know, it being broadly accepted is an interesting one, and has to be disentangled. That, you know, novel and useful. So again, when I give talks about this, it's like, well, there can be an overbalance of novelty, and perhaps the child drawing picture after picture that we love to put on our refrigerators is high on novelty, low on utility. And the word salad of a patient diagnosed with schizophrenia, again, can be novelty, and the neologisms can be fascinating, not particularly useful. The introduction in the field of this concept of surprising or unexpected is, I think, a useful addition. So you have novelty, utility, and unexpectedness, which is also a definition that the patent office uses in terms of granting patents, because you could grant patents to anything that is novel or useful, but it has to be particularly unexpected in order for it to be granted a patent. And getting back to Van Gogh, as you're pronouncing it in the correct pronunciation, novelty and utility that he and his brother saw during the time, and even members of the Impressionist community, were probably important and reasonable, but the unexpected nature of that took time to evolve and become perhaps surprisingly broad, much, much later than the time that his brain created those works of genius.
Hmm. Well, the sort of, I guess, socialization of creativity is a topic that I could, we could go on for a long time, but let's shift it back to the brain. When you're working with imaging, what is happening during an imaging study, during a creative process? What are you seeing, whether it's a big C creative or a little C creative?
It's usually in terms of imaging, it's usually putting someone in the scanner and engaging them with a measure of what's called divergent thinking. This is the standard measure of creative cognition is a measure of divergent thinking. Comes from Torrance tests of creative thinking, which is the standardized test of creative activity, creative cognition. Most stereotypically, it is asking a subject to tell you how many different ways they can think of to use a brick, usually a standard item. It's scored in terms of fluency, how many different items you generate, frequency, kind of different categories of items that you generate, if it's building items or if it's decorative items, let's stay using a brick, and then originality of the items produced, which is really where the rubber meets the road, is where you're getting true novelty along with utility. It's not just crazy ideas to use a brick that won't work, but you know, using a brick to draw on a sidewalk because you can use it as kind of a bit of chalk, which is it's kind of unexpected that you actually could use a brick in a completely new way to write a message on a sidewalk or something like that, or to displace water in a toilet tank. It's using it as an object to displace another object, and yeah, so this notion of originality is often used. So putting someone in the scanner, asking them to tell me as many different new uses for a chair that you can think of, or a pen, is the standard way. Unfortunately, the reliability and validity of these measures are quite low compared to measures of intelligence, where the reliability and validity are quite high. The other problem is the reliability and validity of fMRI measures, functional magnetic resonance imaging, is relatively and significantly lower than structural neuroimaging techniques, which I prefer to use, which are quite high. The reliability is exceptionally high, and the validity measures are relatively high. So you have in these functional techniques that have been used a low reliability, low validity behavioral measure combined with a low reliability, low validity imaging measure that has been used to talk about construct creativity that is quite diffused when you put all those pieces together. So there's some problems in our field that I've tried to call out, that we need better measures, both behavioral and neuroimaging measures and combination of measures to get at this construct. And we need to use something like intelligence as kind of the gold standard, which is one of the better behavioral measures, one of the best behavioral measures that we have of human behavior, as something to aspire to.
Okay. Well, sort of shifting a little bit, would be to sort of the area of creativity in sort of a pathologic way. We often learn about things from looking at the pathologies. And maybe just to start off with the idea, and I think it's a myth that one must have some pathology to be a big C creative. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit? Whether is that a myth or is that actually accurate?
There's always some thread of accuracy in these myths. It's just how they become what we call neuromythologies. Mm-hmm. And I've written on this and spoken of this, but I think there is a thread of truth in this, but it is a neuromythology. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you don't have to be crazy to be creative or bipolar to be creative.
You might have to suffer, but that's again a different question.
Okay, so. You might have to suffer, and actually creative people do have this unreasonable seeming high creative people really do have this unreasonable level of persistence. Mm-hmm. That really seems to win the day, that they just keep mm-hmm. fighting for their ideas well beyond what would normal people do, and that tends to win the
could
day.
That, I mean, okay, this is probably pushing it, but I wonder, because one might argue that that's a cognitive inflexibility.
You could argue that it's a cognitive inflexibility, but the novelty generation ability of these people would belie that notion. It is a personality variable, this persistence and stubbornness and disagreeableness, mm-hmm. Which is the personality characteristic that tends to be, well, openness to new experiences is the most correlated with creative mm-hmm. achievement variables, but disagreeableness also tends to be highly correlated with high creative achievement. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a not going along with the crowd type of behavior, and not a non-conformity. Okay. That tends to be more correlated. So it's not cognitive inflexibility. It's lack of conformity that tends to be the personality characteristic that we're talking about.
Which, again, sort of sounds like that unconstrained notion.
Yeah, it's lack of social constraints that people are manifesting in their behavior. And to get back to your original question, I mean, we do see correlates of people with bipolar disorder and higher levels of creative cognition, people with frontotemporal dementia, and higher levels of novelty generation, creative capacity. So, you know, there are hints of these myths as manifested in the neurological and psychiatric literature that you can see, particularly, and if you think about it from a neuropsychological perspective or from a psychological perspective, that this could induce more novelty generation to take the brakes off the frontal lobes. Would at least a little bit would in terms of bipolar disorder perhaps, or a lot of it in terms of frontotemporal dementia, you could have much more novelty generation. I also like to say that, you know, you never would have someone create anything in the throes of a frank psychosis of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or delusions associated with frontotemporal dementia. So it's usually the periods between the depressions or the manic behavior that people are producing something that is
right. I would imagine the utility is the problem.
Utility is the problem. It's like all your ideas are
right. Lots of novelty.
Which is the problem of the disease. Yeah,
lots of novelty, lots of unexpectedness, not a lot of utility.
Yeah.
But there are pathological creative, or there are creative pathologies. So hypergraphia, for example. Could you
Absolutely.
Talk maybe a little bit about that? Maybe not hypergraphia specifically, but sort of when does creativity kind of become a problem?
I don't know if that is a problem. I kind of wish I could be more hypergraphic.
Well, some of the things I've read about it, it's like one of those things, it sounds great until you have it. But
until you're compelled to write. Yeah, I mean, I think Dostoevsky, I believe, was hypergraphic. and probably, I mean, it's associated often with temporal lobe epilepsy. So you have hypergraphia, not inevitably, but often associated with temporal lobe abnormalities, whether it's a tumor or temporal lobe epilepsy. And you have some famous figures in history who just are compelled to write and are hypergraphic. And it is a compulsion, and some things are novel and useful. But if you produce, there is a equal odds rule that Dean K. Simonton talks about, that enough, if you put out enough idea, if you put out a lot of ideas, along for the ride will be a good idea every once in a while. So the production of ideas in aggregate will increase the likelihood of producing a novel and useful idea. So fluency yields creativity. So in this hypergraphic state, there's a lot of junk and trash and garbage that's produced. But if you can, during a lucid state, hone it down into something that is a gem or a work of art, then
it sounds a little bit like the infinite number of monkeys coming up with Shakespeare's, the works of Shakespeare.
Well, it reminds, so when I was in, I don't know, Germany on a trip one time, I saw that there was going to be a exhibit of Picasso's. He had some dishes or something that he had painted. And it's like, let's go see that. So it's Picasso. Let's go see that. It's going to be great. Picasso, the genius artist. And we went, and it was terrible. Later found, I started researching this, but Picasso produced over 25,000 individual pieces of art in his lifetime. And a lot of it is really terrible. Mm-hmm. He produced Guernica, which is his work of genius. But he also produced some really terrible art, just really something worse than a child would produce that you may not even put on your refrigerator. And so, but it's just that volume that led to some really stunning works of genius as well.
Well, we've talked about sort of the neurology of it a little, about of pathology. I'd like to take a break now, and then when we come back, maybe talk a little bit about whether we can improve creativity, and we have to, you know, talk the inevitable talk about artificial intelligence and what that might happen.
Yes.
So we'll be back.
You're listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Dr. Rex Jung. You can find out more about him and his work in the show notes or at www.rexjung.com. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neural feedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society of Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.